The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
People are actually putting it together, and what Keynes said would be hidden from almost everyone in the general public is no longer hidden to the French. They've figured it out. Why? Because, yes, inflationism is something that we exported years ago. Yes, central bank hooliganism and gerrymandering is something that we popularized, perfected, and then handed off to the rest of the world's central banks to then use and abuse their public with. This is a very, very big thing.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You know, sometimes, Dave, because we're on a well at home, you know, we have 5 acres and we're on a well, sometimes the well runs dry. And it's really, it's a helpless feeling when the thing shuts off and nothing comes out of the spigots because we're just used to it being there all the time. Now, I'm referencing Europe right now because Europe has been like the well that doesn't run dry. They've been the liquidity spigot for the markets there in Europe. And now they're basically saying, wait, we're not going to do that anymore. We're turning the well off.
That's what marks a very momentous occasion this week, this Thursday. The ECB turns off the QE tap after 4 years of monetizing corporate and government debt. So you've had the artificial buyer of first and last resort. They've said that we're going to be leaving the room. I just wonder if the impact of that could be a shift in prices and in the yields of bonds there in the Eurozone. We discussed this last week with Doug Noland. Is tightening of the corporate bond and government credit markets in Europe sufficient to impact the bond markets globally and specifically here in the United States? I think the answer then last week and today and this week as we watch the ECB finally turn off the tap, probably.
Well, you know, I measure the flow in gallons from my well. They measure it in trillions from what they've added as stimulus over the last 4 years.
That's right. $2.95 trillion of stimulus. And the question is, has that solved any of Europe's core dysfunctional issues? Or did it merely buy time and bring the markets off the boil? You know, you've got the ECB's next chapter. And if you go back to your childhood and those choose your own adventure stories, now you can say, all right, central bank there in Europe gets to turn to page 13. Or, I mean, in this case, you could turn to page 6 of the last Interest Rate Observer. This is by Jim Grant. Jim notes that the economists at the Swedish Trade Union Confederation, 9 of them, are protesting loudly about the associated risks of the Riksbank, that's the Swedish central bank, the oldest central bank in the world, raising rates by a quarter of a point. Now, this is a big deal. We know the impact of raising rates here in the United States. We know the potential implications of raising rates. And they are, as a unanimous voice, concerned about the raising of interest rates in Sweden.
Of 25 basis points. You know, they've been in the news quite a bit here recently because Sweden, no wonder they want to go to a cashless system. That way they can keep negative rates for forever.
You know, well, that's the point, is that they're talking about raising interest rates from negative 50 basis points to only negative 25. And this could have serious implications for the labor markets in Sweden. And you have to ask yourself the question, what kind of a twilight zone have we created with all this central bank largesse of the last 10 years or so?
I can hear Carmen Reinhart right now echoing, we have to create a captive audience. We have to create a captive audience.
How about a mindless audience?
Well, you know, 4,000 of the Swedes have already taken an implant in their hand for buying and selling. They're perfectly fine with it. You know, that was in Bloomberg. That was all the major news sources said, cashless system is very, very palatable to the Swedes. Yep. Okay, but let me ask you something, because when we've had recession in the past, there's been something that's triggered that recession, or at least been a sign of the recession, and that is when short-term interest rates actually exceed the yield of long-term rates.
And this doesn't guarantee that you go into recession, but the last 3 recessions that we've had, there has been an inversion which occurred some months prior, as many as 26 months prior, according to Bespoke Investments. And it was Reuters last week that was sort of reminding the public that indebtedness has shifted to corporations. And it was fascinating. I listened to a CNBC interview the other day, and there was one man who was kind of marked as the curmudgeon, marked as the guy kind of out of touch. And then they had these two very well-dressed younger people who were saying, look, you just don't understand. We have not seen a huge increase in debt over the last 10 years. Look at households. And the guy scratching his head, unfortunately, was not fast enough on his feet. But the trillions of dollars that we have seen in liquidity expansion and debt liabilities, both on central bank balance sheets and corporations, is absolutely staggering. And I was sitting there at the wealth management office wanting to rip the television off the wall, just saying, come on, come on. And actually, it was left alone and settled. According to the public's view of things, it's okay. We don't have too much leverage in the system.
Well, as I get older, Dave, a lot of these guys in suits get younger, obviously. And I've noticed from crisis to crisis to crisis, a lot of the guys who are giving expert opinions were not in the industry at the last crisis. And
no, so, in fact, 50% of current investment advisors were not in the markets during the last bear market.
Well, let me ask you, if corporations are carrying this much debt, this is sort of a bad time to have high debt, isn't it? Because remember what Pollock said a few weeks ago? He said, your assets can fall, but the liabilities stay the same. Now, the liabilities actually are increasing because interest rates are.
Well, corporates are at all-time highs in terms of their total debt load. And that does come at a very inconvenient time as rates threaten to move higher. And for me, this serves as a reminder of there being decades in which equities do not offer up any growth to investors. I mean, we're talking about debt, right? But it's the problem of having too much debt and having to pay interest on it that ends up prohibiting the growth or the use of assets towards productive ends within a corporate environment. So again, the driver, the primary driver of growth in assets, specifically stocks, it's liquidity. It's liquidity. It's always been liquidity. Number one, you've got central banks, which have created a bunch of that stuff, liquidity. And by and large, they're saying they won't continue to, at least for now. And right. I think that's a key caveat. But number two, you've got rates, which are increasing, which is like the slow restriction of flow, like a clogged artery or a collapsed artery. The need for flow doesn't change, but the restriction of flow becomes consequential, with prices in the market beginning to reflect that strain. It's like a systemic strain.
So did I hear wrong? You talked about equities not always offering up growth. Now, our generation has grown up hearing that if you just buy and hold stocks, you will make a given return.
That's right. Well, that's Professor Siegel, not the bird at the beach. It's the bird who wrote Stocks for the Long Run. And, you know, it's interesting because we've noted that his time series start about when the Ibbotson time series start, which is in the 20s, but not before. And he leaves these huge swaths of data untouched, which actually are pretty relevant to understanding long-term market returns in stocks. 1852 to 1932, virtually the entire return in stocks, if you were an investor, came from the dividend.
Right.
They came from the dividend. There was very limited upside when all was said and done in equities over that particular 80-year period. In the latter part of the 20th century, of course, we've had the stock bull market, 1982 to the year 2000, and that helped pull the averages for this century considerably higher, right? And so, you know, they do usually go back to 1926 to include the Great Depression, but they don't include any of the lumpiness, the lumpy periods, the loser periods before that, which actually were pretty significant. It was one episode. This period of 1982 to the year 2000, with a few non-repeatable inputs that have shifted everyone's mentality and thinking to this idea that stocks are always a good bet.
Well, and how much of that rise came from the printing of money? Because if you go back to the years when they weren't able to print money, inflation was not as much of an issue.
Yeah, and granted, there are periods of time where innovation and demographics boost the markets, and that certainly was a part of the 82 to 2000 boom. But The periods of pure growth are more limited than the classic Ibbotson performance charts would infer, and frankly, a lot of growth in the 20th century, in nominal terms, comes from inflation.
Right, the printing of money.
Yeah, the biggest numbers, of course, again, we're coming back to that time frame where we've seen massive growth, complemented by a post-Bretton Woods fiat period. So again, what did we do in that 1982 to 2000 period as we're beginning to see, and particularly after the fall of the Berlin Wall, and as democracy begins to take root in lots of different parts of the world, one of the things that we exported was the idea of inflationism and the way to run a monetary system, right? So that has begun to take hold throughout the world.
You know, just a quick memory. I was in Berlin 5 years after the Berlin Wall fell down, and we stayed in a hotel that could, just on the west side, you could see where the wall was because of those gigantic cranes building. Of course, Eastern Germany had not been built up, but all the new money that was going to be made with the unification of Germany, there was a new wall. If you can imagine, you know those real tall cranes that are a couple of hundred feet tall that build buildings?
Yep.
You could see, I don't know, I might exaggerate by saying hundreds, but you could see tens and tens and tens and tens of them right along where the wall was. You could tell that that was going to be a one-time economic boom, and people were taking advantage of it. So what you're saying, I mean, look at that time period that you're quoting, 82 to 2000, there were some major changes that turned into economic productivity.
Well, and again, I think this is something we can't forget. We don't have the end of communism coming this century such that we have an unleashing of global growth forces complemented by fiat currency, monetary policies in a post-Bretton Woods period. You had all of those things swirling in the 1982 to 2000 period. Why do I mention that? Because if you have an expectation of growth in the stock market, which looks remotely like this recent period in our past, up to the year 2000, you have to realize that this is a period which is an anomaly. It is an anomaly. An expansion in credit. And we were able to expand credit dramatically because there were no limits to the amount that we could expand money and credit. Plus, we get the end of communism dividend, which was absolutely massive. Now, I want to look at a few stats, not just from the 20th century, but also the 21st century, which I think are instructive. Maybe more on that in a little bit.
Well, let me ask you something, though, because we're not only talking about economic inputs that may never repeat. We're also talking, okay, let's say that you're just a retirement planner right now, okay, a financial planner. All the models that a financial planner are going to use, you know, you've been using this 82 to 2000 period, but let's just take it from 82 till now. Every one of those retirement planning models is built on falling interest rates,
but it's not just
rising interest rates.
It's not just your run-of-the-mill retirement planner. It's your endowment manager. It's your pension fund investment committee, which is counted on average expected returns, and over the last several decades have shifted an unhealthy percentage in the direction of equities and away from debt. And the point is, they're assuming that they're going to capture the risk premium in equities, and what they may capture instead is just the risk end of the stick.
Probably the greatest change that I've seen in the 31 years that I've done this is the last 10 years especially, the role of central banks. Central banks now play almost the primary role in market moves.
Well, right. I mean, what you saw was a central bank experimentation following the end of Bretton Woods, which started with some baby steps. And frankly, I mean, the story goes back, obviously, to the Great Depression, when our central bank, the Fed, really didn't understand how to operate in the context of crisis. They'd only been around since 1913, so there in the 30s, they hadn't really been given the keys to the kingdom, and it was only in the context of crisis that they asked for them and ultimately were given them. But since then, they've gone from baby steps to, you know, the strides that you see from someone like Usain Bolt, the fastest sprinter in the world,
right?
These are the guys that not only now have the reputation and the rock star status, but have begun to get very experimental. So just one bit of trivia here, central bank trivia, just to end this thought. And I want to give you kind of an example of a negative feedback loop. Where was inflation targeting by a central bank first experimented with?
Well, I don't know. You know, we were talking about John Maynard Keynes was nothing new. You know, 300 years ago, they were experimenting with things like that. So does it go a ways back?
Inflation targeting is the idea that if you are designing a system to create inflation, you will at the same time create economic activity and growth because of that targeted inflation.
If you print it, they will come.
Right. So and now we actually have a range of inflation rates that are considered acceptable and, in fact, optimal for promoting economic growth. Ours is a 2% target. We have a few global examples of 4% and of 6%. And there's even a central bank out there today which has a targeted inflation rate of 13%.
Wow.
So who got the party started? And not the fiat party. That was us. That was us here in the United States.
Right.
But the idea that we should whitewash and sell as something that's beautiful and pristine, what throughout history has more consistently destroyed and redistributed wealth than any other financial factor, that one factor, inflation. I know it's the tip of your tongue. I know inflation targeting, these are the things that you think about. And I know if you're playing in the game show with the game show host, you'd say, yes, I'll take inflation targeting for 200. New Zealand, 1989.
So we got our inflation targeting cue from New Zealand.
The fun fact of the week comes from Robert Shiller at Yale.
Okay.
He wrote a fascinating article in Project Syndicate this last week, and he's asking the question, guys, are we playing with fire here? We're creating inflation, and by the way, there's perhaps some unintended consequences. He, consummate diplomat, he doesn't want to scare anyone with inflation, but he's asking all the right questions. So there we have it, New Zealand, 1989, the original experimentors with inflation targeting.
Yeah, for the person who doesn't quite understand what inflation targeting is, that basically is theft targeting, because it's saying you, your buying power of your money will be worth 2% less per year. It's like buying a bucket. You know, when you go down to Home Depot, you buy those, you know, those big orange buckets. What if you had the bucket that had a 2% hole?
What?
And a bucket that had a 4 or 6 or New Zealand, what was that?
You know? Right. Well, and this is the fiction that we all live with. You know, if you talk to your grandparents and they say, listen, when I built our first house, I paid less than $10,000 for it.
Right.
And this is the house that I have in retirement today, and I'm selling it for $250,000. And you think to yourself, wow, the house price has really gone up. The reality is the greatest factor in that appreciation was not supply and demand in the real estate market. It was the central bank creating more money so that it takes more of those same dollars to buy the same sticks, bricks, and mortar.
But if everything's working perfectly right, let's say the last 10 years, go ahead and let them print, because the markets are going to give it back to you. But it seems at this point, since October, we've had a lot of damage done in the markets.
Absolutely. And I think the markets are in a very vulnerable place. Technical damage was done last week in the equity markets, even as we were talking with Doug Noland. And what I mean by technical damage, the prices have gone below certain levels and triggered what some consider to be a long-term sell signal.
Hmm.
Bill King, in his note from last Friday, says that an estimated 6 sell programs hit stocks on Thursday before the European close.
Somebody knows something.
He says this indicates that large institutions are liquidating more aggressively. Charts and market action from October clearly show that large entities had begun to sell equities. This week's actions, again, this is quoted from last week Friday, the King Report, they suggest that downward momentum is begetting more selling urgency, which produces the dreaded self-reinforcing negative psychology. That's the end of the quote. As we mentioned last week, and again, drawing from Grant's Interest Rate Observer, Deutsche Bank, looking at performance of asset classes through mid-November, has 90% of dollar-denominated asset classes, 90% of all dollar-denominated asset classes that they track are negative for the year.
Mm.
Right? So this is the highest share of losers since 1901. The important aspect here is the correlation increase. The majority of categories of assets, it doesn't matter. They're not supposed to be moving in lockstep. Stocks and bonds are not supposed to be doing the same thing at the same time. But the majority of categories are in the losing side of the equation all at once. Doesn't matter if you balance between stocks and bonds when both are in the red.
Oh, 3 or 4 weeks ago, we talked about the 50-day moving average moving below the 200-day moving average. That looks like it's happening.
Right. Well, as we speak, and it's what they call a death cross, the translation of, you know, the 50-day moving below the 200-day is this. The short to intermediate trend has been down long enough that it may now influence the long-term trend similarly to the downside.
Now, what does that mean, though? Does that mean for sure that the market's going to be falling?
It's not a perfect predictor. I mean, we had the last death cross, quote-unquote, in the first quarter of 2016, and we managed to raise the dead thereafter. But nevertheless, it's a warning that should be noted. And, you know, the 10-year bull appears to be capitulating. And of course, what's tricky is that even though psychology is shifting, you have news feeds, you have algorithms, you've got the Twitter surprises from the president, whether it's on trade or some other topic, that can create a violent upsurge, counter trend upsurge in price.
You know, if you were wise beyond your years and you somehow could look into the future, you really would only have to buy the market if you were in a bear market, a down market. You'd really only have to buy if you knew what days it would rally, you could just buy the rallies, because those rallies can be incredibly violent.
That's right. Well, and I think what you see in a bull market, this is true. The violence of a market always marks the countertrend, or typically, let me say that more conservatively, typically marks the countertrend move. So in a bull market where progress is steady to the upside, very slow and steady, making gains, you have violent moves, countertrend moves to the downside. In a bear market, the opposite is true. There's a steady erosion in price. I've described it once as the bowling ball falling slowly and then rolling down and falling and hitting the next set of stairs. But the word picture fails, frankly, because it doesn't capture the violent countertrend moves to the upside. You can have these massive spikes higher in price. And when violent moves in the market are present, they generally represent countertrend moves. Last week, we had the combined pressure of trade relations deteriorating and a weaker than expected non-farms payroll report on Friday, which are continuing to pressure the market lower. Guess what? We had had the violent spike upwards the week before, and then again, it begins to fall apart again last week.
Well, and then what about geopolitics? Because, you know, America's legal reach seems to be a little bit larger than just the United States. You know, and that affected the markets last week when we're nabbing executives.
It's tough to think of functional trade relations with the Chinese when the U.S. is taking their executives from foreign soil while those executives are in transit.
That was in Canada that she was picked up.
It makes you think about jurisdiction. It makes you think about who we are in the world and how our laws extend and to what boundaries they go to. Break our laws in our country, I get it. How would I like to be prosecuted for breaking a law in Turkey right now? Or let's say, for instance, I was defaming Muhammad. Should I be subject to Iranian laws? Like, at what point do Iranian laws not apply in the United States, or Syrian laws apply in the United States? Is there anything in terms of jurisdiction that we should appreciate here? And I just... This is confusing to me because, again, if you break our laws as a non-citizen and you're in our country, yes, you're subject to them, but break our laws as a non-citizen in another jurisdiction, how is it that we get to hunt you down?
Well,
there are interesting presumptions in that.
Is it because we have the reserve currency? And is it because we have the carrier fleet?
I think it's more
the military.
There you go. I think it's the carrier fleets. I think it's the long-range bombers. I don't know that having the reserve currency gives us the ability to extend the long arm of the law. I think it's the long range of the bombers that allows us to extend the long arm of the law.
But we're losing the love of the countries outside of the United States.
Listen, I don't have to be Chinese to feel awkward in this moment. I don't feel warm and friendly about the idea. But just try this on. See if the shoe fits, theoretically. Let's say that Russia asks China to capture and extradite one of our top executives. Let's say that Mark Zuckerberg is traveling through Beijing and he's detained by the Chinese and is going to be extradited to Russia to be tried because he has, through his social media posts, allowed for defamation of the state of the Great Bear. Can you imagine? Can you imagine them going after him and using the Chinese as a puppet to get what they want?
What would be our reaction?
What's our sense of things as a country? I mean, can we fit this into the category of do unto others as you would have them to do unto you? I'm very uncomfortable with this, but this goes back to a philosophical argument that Alistair MacIntyre raised in his book, Whose Justice, Which Rationality? Alistair's 89 years old. to me, he's like the second version of the Scottish Enlightenment in terms of, you know, what he brought to philosophy as a Catholic philosopher. But you see these competing interpretations in his book, Whose Justice, Which Rationality? Interpretations of those ideas, justice and rationality, according to different theoretical starting points, whether it's Aristotle or Aquinas or Augustine or Hume. And there's more competing views in the world than just these. But the conversation through time on the topics of justice, on the idea of rationality, it has these names in the dialogue. So what we're really talking about is our justice and our rationality.
From the United States point of view.
Whatever the basis we have for it, and it's not universally agreed upon. So when we construct an argument justifying a certain action according to a certain interpretation of our law, we should not be surprised when other state actors sit there, scratch their heads, and wonder how the hell we think we are justified in our actions extending beyond our borders. Again, how to win friends and influence people, I don't think this is how you get it done.
You know, for the last 11 years almost on this program, we've talked about the financial going to the economic going to the political, and then ultimately the geopolitical. The geopolitical is a little bit different. It starts to get bloody. And, you know, right now, the relationships that we are trying to negotiate with these trade negotiations are starting to look more like they're warlike negotiations.
Well, yeah, I mean, because our actions are inflammatory and they don't necessarily help dialogue. And the markets figured that out instantly last week. When you saw the announcement, actually it happened, started happening a little bit before. Someone else knew ahead of time and knew what the implications would be, but you began to see a sell-off in the markets directly related to the nabbing of this telecom exec from China. So the volatility increased. It increased before Friday, and then you layer in the non-farm payroll disappointment. We had 155,000 jobs when 198,000 was expected. And again, Bill King notes this week, real sellers are now regularly overwhelming traders and pattern trades. This trend, which began in October, suggests that the long bull market has ended. That was his quote.
That answers a question that we've been asking now at least for 5 years, maybe more. When will the real market return? And it seems that real sellers, what King is saying is real sellers are overwhelming the algorithms.
It feels like the gods of the copybook headings all over again.
Mm.
You know, where the market actually does return. You've got the posturing of the president on trade negotiations, and this is one for the history books. These are the strongest trade negotiating tactics ever witnessed. I don't think that you'll ever see anything more radical than his.
Do you think that's good for the United States?
Well, I mean, I don't know, but I know that he's not a diplomat, he's not a politician, and he's driving policy. I mean, technically he's a politician, but he doesn't have a history as being a professional politician. That's what I'm saying.
Right.
And he's driving policy, and it could move the needle favorably for the U.S., and I think so far it has. But this is the danger point. It may be moving the needle for us economically, but it could also move fingers to buttons. And there is a risk, even if we hold the perfect poker hand, that number one, China can either fold, or as we can recall from the days of poker matches in the Old West, the second alternative is that accusations can fly, guns can be drawn, and it makes the royal flush we hold completely irrelevant.
Yeah, the cards no longer matter. It's now bullets.
No, someone's dead lying on the street, and it didn't matter if he had the perfect hand.
You know, I had mentioned what it feels like when the well runs dry, and because you just assume every single time you want to get a drink of water or whatever, it's going to be there. I have to say I'm a little sad, Dave. Alan Newman is somebody that I love getting the latest charts from. He's been doing this for longer than I've been alive, I think, almost. He's retiring, and he's a regular guest of ours. I hope that he'll continue to do guest appearances on the show. But aren't you sad that you're not going to be getting your cross currents on a regular basis?
So I am sad, and yet I understand it. I mean, he said to me on a personal note, there's a few other things that my wife and I would like to do.
Right, right.
And I get it. I get it. I mean, the markets have been a 54-year obsession. He has written his millionth word on the market, and the last cross-currents issue is in hand. Of course, that he might change his mind, and there might be a special issue in February, and you know, I'm going into retirement, but I might not be fully retired. I'll have to tell you in 2019, and it'll be a surprise event.
Well, would you summarize at least what he's saying, since this is the last issue? What is it that he's looking for over the next couple of years?
Yeah, the last sort of swan song issue of Cross Currents says the Dow's heading to 15,000, gold's heading to 3,500, maybe even 5,000, but the important number is not in nominal terms, it's really the ratio. He's looking for a 5-to-1 Dow-gold ratio. It's about 20-to-1 at present, so you're looking at a 4x increase in purchasing power owning gold relative to stocks. And I personally vary off of that opinion. I think that geopolitical factors may take the ratio a bit below that, back to the classic 3-to-1, maybe even 2 or 1-to-1. But again, I think regardless, even getting to a 5-to-1 ratio, that's good news for gold owners. Give yourself a few years and the picture which you thought would be in view will be. The market does what it's supposed to do, but as Richard Russell used to say, not when you want it to.
You know, someone else that you read on a regular basis is Fred Hickey. And, you know, his specialty is tech stocks. Okay, that's what he really does his business in. But he was on the Barron's Roundtable for years.
Absolutely. And he agrees that gold over the next few years has great prospects. When Fred's not tearing through the financials of tech company, he's one of the best at that, for sure. He is, or I should say he has been, an advocate of physical metals and of the mining sector. And, you know, the gist is that tailwinds, that is, that which helps gold, emerge even as headwinds for the world's other financial assets are also present. So, again, as you see pressure in the stock market, gold catches a bid. Anything relating to gold does very well in that context. We had a decade of that being the dominant story and theme leading up to Barron's in 2012, throwing in the towel. They've always been bearish gold, and there in 2012, they finally said, everyone needs to own it. To their chagrin, their timing was absolutely awful. And I think they'll be again on the bandwagon saying everyone needs to own it, but it'll probably be in that price range of what Alan Newman suggests, 3,500 to 5,000 before Barron's again is on the bandwagon.
You know, I think of some of the guys that we read regularly and no longer can, or read regularly and no longer can. You know, we had Richard Russell for years, for 5-6 decades. We were able to read his material. Alan Newman, that's another one. Fred Hickey is another one with the high-tech strategist. But honestly, and we've talked about how wonderful it is to have this close, but another person that we would have added to that list is Doug Noland with the Credit Bubble Bulletin. And, you know, his Z1 report, he's still very actively writing. So we no longer have Richard Russell. We no longer have, well, Ian McCavity. All right. Alan Newman is retiring. We've still got Hickey, but Noland, we had him on last week. We had great feedback from that conversation. That's something I just want to encourage our listeners. You can read the Credit Bubble Bulletin for free. Simply go to mwealthm.com and click on the Credit Bubble Bulletin tab.
2000 to 2005 were very important years for me. They were the years that I was at Morgan Stanley and then made the transition to our family business, the wealth management and precious metals brokerage company. And in those years, the influential voices in my head were Richard Russell, who I read every day right, without fail, and on a weekly basis, Doug Noland. But I didn't get to read Noland's comments daily. What I did get at prudentbear.com was a list of articles which shrunk the universe down to a bite-sized portion and allowed me to go to the top Reuters, top Bloomberg, top CNBC, top articles from the Financial Times and every other news rag in the universe, because he had already distilled what was most important and was going to be
true. He was showing you what he was reading.
That's right. And that to me has always been the key. If you find somebody you enjoy reading, find their bibliography. Find who influences them, right?
So your life is defined by bibliography.
In many respects.
It really is.
In many respects. So yeah, the Credit Bubble Bulletin this last week, when I read Doug over the weekend, and that is a ritual I suggest, the review of the Federal Reserve's Z1 report was most helpful. What it made me think is that Richard Koo nailed it 15 years ago. Still an economist working in Japan, going to be a guest on our program in February or March, I think March actually, and looking forward to our conversation with him. But his explanation of why growth is constrained in an era of over-indebtedness, what he called the balance sheet recession. These are the issues which we're talking about and looking at in the Z1 report, and they're very significant. Though there is a slowing in credit growth in some areas, growth in others, Coup popularized that idea of the balance sheet recession. Again, mm-hmm. in a nutshell, it's having too much in debt such that much of your productive potential, that is economic potential, is sapped by feeding the interest meter.
That goes back to Pollock's quote I just brought up earlier. You know, your debt doesn't go away when your assets do.
Right. And the only thing that central banks have done for us is artificially capture the rate of interest and hold it down. Central bank QE programs have bought a lower interest rate. Now, we still have to pay for it, but they financed a lower interest rate, and they've kept those rates at a level that has at least allowed for slow economic growth to be in the picture. Now, with rates rising, you can begin to see the vulnerability to global and domestic economic growth. Because, yes, debt kills. And if you have more of it, it just happens to kill faster. That's the nature of leverage when it's working in reverse. You might be tempted to say that maybe we're moving towards an era where capitalism has revealed its weaknesses and is moving towards the dustbin of history, and we have in its place autocratic regimes like the Chinese taking the best of capitalism and massaging it into their own framework.
Mm-hmm.
It'll never matter because they have the ability to control the system. And it's true. They have the commercial banks. Those are tools of the state. They have the central bank. That's available to serve the party's priorities. Therefore, maybe it's different. But banking and credit, I would contend, even in a controlled environment, still succumbs to natural laws.
That's the real market. That's exactly what we were talking about with King. The real market sometimes overwhelms the control, the algorithms, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, the only difference is that the losers, when they are assigned the losses, really have no recourse.
Mm.
Right? So in a democracy, if you're a loser and you're assigned the losses, you can take it to the polls and you can make the politician who allowed the dirty system that abused you to get cleaned up or go away. Right? So there is political recourse. In the autocracy, you will still be assigned the loss because there are losses to be assigned. There are consequences to bad debt. You just don't have any political choice. You don't have any political recourse. Unless you take a big enough hit and then maybe you just decide to blow up the system. Stranger things have happened. If you look at the continuity of regimes through time, autocracies, show me one autocracy that has lasted more than, I don't know, 500 years, 1,000 years. None that exists today existed, you know, in the 1500s, 1600s, even 1700s.
One of our guests years ago, Barry Eichengreen, talked about the dollar's reserve status as an exorbitant privilege. We seem to be losing that. The Chinese are looking more and more like they want oil backing the yuan. You know, the dollar, the reserve status of the dollar was protected mainly by OPEC and its oil trade. Now the world's basically saying, I think we can buy oil in something else.
Yeah, no, and I think this issue that the Chinese are working through is very significant because we've got many of the themes in motion, some that people are aware of, some that people are not focusing enough on. Look at Enron. Enron was okay as long as they were able to use special purpose vehicles and able to shuffle off the nasty, bad liabilities and maintain a perfectly clean balance sheet for Wall Street to look at. And they lied, and they got Arthur Andersen to lie for them. In an autocracy, you don't have to have Arthur Andersen lie for you. You can do anything you want. The Chinese today show 1.5% of all their loans as bad. Which means really that the stinky stuff has already been quarantined.
Right.
When we talk about the problem with wealth management products and the blow up of these other assets in China, they've already taken a lot of the garbage and given it to the general public because the general public can own it, have bought it thinking that they were going to make their millions and lose. And really, what is the recourse? Now, you raise a totally different issue on the Petro Yuan, and it's a very interesting one because we've got trade, we've got currency conflicts, we've got territorial disputes. All of those three things, trade, currency conflicts, and territorial disputes, they're all taking place with China, between us and China, in the context of the 10-month run since the launch of the yuan-denominated oil futures contract on the Shanghai International Energy Exchange. So whether you call it yuan or RMB, you've gone now 10 months, and it's captured the interest of Glencore. Its volumes have exceeded a number of other exchanges.
It was an experiment to start, wasn't it? And the experiment seems to be working.
Yep. And this is the importance. There are few things which support the development of the Chinese capital markets and bring the RMB into the center of global commodity trading than adding to demand for RMB via the oil markets. The oil markets are ubiquitous. Demand for oil requires a certain degree of commitment to a currency. And if you can settle those currency contracts, those oil contracts in the currency of your choice versus dollars doing RMB or some other currency, then that I think is a significant trend. The governor of the PBOC back in 2009, Zhu Xiaoxuan, I apologize, I did not pronounce that correctly, he wrote in depth back in 2009 about the inadequacies of the dollar-centered monetary system. And he was a proponent of the RMB's inclusion into the IMF and the SDR system, that is a special drawing right system, which creates a basket of currencies, and the RMB is now a part of that. But he viewed it, the former governor of the PBOC, viewed RMB inclusion in the SDR system as a stepping stone to greater things. And here we have 2018. While we will generally remember it for trade conflict with China, the bigger issue is the currency issue. And the currency issue is being driven by the Petro Yuan. It's the shot across the bow the Trump administration is not talking about. Mark Faber, in his recent letter, had a quote from Talleyrand in the 1760s, who said that speech was given to man to conceal his thoughts. And I think to myself, as loudly as Trump is trumpeting on the trade issue with China, the trade topic is getting the airtime, and there's the actual topic which deserves airtime and is being completely obfuscated, hidden, and that is the Petro Yuan.
Talking about speech concealing thoughts, Warren Buffett has been awfully quiet now that the index that he talks so much about when things look like they're going to go up is now pointing to a down market. Do you think maybe his speech is concealing his thoughts?
Absolutely. And this is where, again, you look at 2001, you look at the Forbes magazine article where, you know, Buffett is basically saying this is the greatest measure if you want to know if a market is overvalued or undervalued. And as I mentioned in an earlier commentary this year, just this year, January, he's saying, no. It's not overvalued. Stock market is not overvalued. Of course, those comments only make sense if you're comparing stocks to something that is even more outrageously priced, which in this case would be bonds, right? So stocks are cheap relative to bonds, but both are expensive. And this is where, again, the Buffett indicator at 151%, up from the recent 144%, shows that we are getting into and beyond bubble territory. The all-time high for the Buffett indicator was 161% in the year 2000, and we far exceeded what we had in virtually any other period in time. Now, that's using the same Z1 report we talked about earlier, that Doug Noland was digging information from, mining information from. Use the Z1 report for the total value of corporate equities, and you get your 151%. If you compare, on the other hand, the Wilshire 5000 to GDP, we're at all-time highs. So again, look at the speculative nature of small caps and the broader market, and what it reveals is the excessive position that the markets are in. Many of you joined us for the commentary conversation with Crestmont Research's Ed Easterling. If you missed it, it's probably one of the clearest insights into market valuation you'll ever get.
That was an excellent show. And his chart that we put on that site where you can click on it and you can actually look at economic or stock market history for the last century.
If knowing where you are helps you figure out where you are going to end up in this journey of investment returns, I would say it's a vital conversation to review. I mention it because of the variety of valuation metrics that Ed looks at and he develops. And similar to the CAPE, he has his own Crestmont PE. CAPE is the cyclically adjusted price earnings ratio, the PE10, otherwise called. And these are numbers that get routinely updated and show that, yes, we are at the top of the range. Now, I mentioned earlier the impact of inflation. We talked about inflation targeting. And I just wanted to share as we close today the impact of inflation here since the beginning of the millennium. So 2000 to the present, we have the Dow in nominal terms up 117%. Now, when you factor in inflation, it's up 47% instead of 117. The difference between 117 and 47 over the last 18 years is inflation.
That's a leaky bucket.
That's a leaky bucket. The S&P is up 80% in nominal terms, 22% in real terms if you factor in inflation.
That's a leaky bucket.
And the NASDAQ is up 45% since the year 2000, except when you factor in inflation, it's down 1.9%.
Wow. Almost 20 years of no growth when you factor in inflation on the NASDAQ.
Perception versus reality. This is a real thing that people need to be cognizant of. In fact, this is what is the debate in France today. Families, working people, and a populist movement is basically saying the cost of goods and services going up. Our income is not going up commensurate. We're getting squeezed. You're raising taxes. It's intolerable. We're taking to the streets. Again, we've talked about this crisis moving from the financial to the economic to the political to the geopolitical. You're seeing the political in real time in France. Why? Because people are actually putting it together. And what Keynes said would be hidden from almost everyone in the general public is no longer hidden to the French. They've figured it out. Why? Because yes, inflationism is something that we exported years ago. Yes, central bank hooliganism and gerrymandering is something that we popularized, perfected, and then handed off to the rest of the world's central banks to then use and abuse their public with. This is a very, very big thing.
Yeah, a very famous book says, whatever's done in darkness will come to the light. And inflation is something that seems to be done in darkness until, actually, you can't pay your bills.
And then guess what you see? You see yellow jackets and yellow shirts all over the place.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or you can call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.